Welcome to Jessup Think. I'm your host, Mark Moore.
And your co-host, Rex Gurney.
And Rex, so excited to have Jamar Tisby back on the show.
Back on the show for the
back
second
on
time.
The show. He is, an author. We had him on for The Color of Compromise. He's also the president of The Witness, a Black Christian collective, where he writes about race, religion, politics, and culture. And he also co-hosts his own podcast called Pass the Mic. And his The Color of Compromise became a New York Times bestseller this past summer of 2020. And he's just released a new book called How to Fight Racism, Courageous Christianity and the Journey Toward Racial Justice. And I know you as listeners are going to love this episode and learn so much because we learned so much being with him.
That's right.
Well, hey, Jamar, we're so happy to have you back on the show. How have you been since we last had you on the show?
Man, running, going. I'll tell you, though, the holiday season was a bit more low-key and subdued.
Right, for all of us.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there was something to that because we needed every ounce of energy for 2021.
Right. Yeah, that is the truth. That is the truth. And you... So we had you on last time talking about The Color of Compromise, and then you just released a new book, How to Fight Racism, and we're going to be focusing on that. But also, like, I don't think we talked a lot about this last time. In the middle of all this, you're also a PhD candidate.
Look.
From the University of Mississippi. Like, how are you... How are you doing all this?
Listen, I don't know that I am doing any of it, at least not very well. And so, yeah, that is a super challenge. I'll tell you, the dynamic is good, though, because that the type of work required to write a dissertation is like this deep, focused work where you're just in a silo. And I feel like it steeps you in knowledge and information and data and truth. And then when you come up for air and you see current events and everything, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to pursue this degree in history, was to be able to bring all of that deep study, that academic rigor, and just the context of history to what we're experiencing right now. So I like that going back and forth. I think if I was not in the program with everything that's going on right now, I would just be even more scattered than I am. So,
yeah.
And speaking of right now, we're actually doing this podcast on January the 7th, 2021, which is one day after January the 6th. And, So just kind of places us right now in the context of what we're talking about. And we really want to give you a voice, Jamar, because we respect it so much. We really do want to get to your book, but, do you have anything to say about what happened yesterday, especially in conjunction with, you know, the fact that frankly, the crowd that stormed the Capitol was almost completely white.
Yeah. I sort of am processing it on three levels, an emotional level, a historical level, and a spiritual level. So on the emotional level, my goodness, how frustrating is all of this? It is so, I mean, obviously disheartening, frightening to a degree, but also frustrating, in particular as a Black writer. I've been talking about these things, and in particular putting words to them in writing literally for years. But in the more recent past, at least, you know, since the 2016 presidential cycle. And there are so many like me who because of our social location, racially, ethnically, we are canaries in the coal mine for these kinds of things. So we heard the rhetoric. We saw the people who were attracted to this president and this administration. And we said, hey, this is not good for us. And so many people minimized it, ignored those calls. And what is frustrating is that it could have been prevented or at least mitigated had we taken action sooner. So that's the emotional level. On a historical level, there are all kinds of parallels. My mind jumped immediately back to the aftermath of the Civil War. And here you have sedition, rebellion, treason on a national scale that led to what is to this day the bloodiest war the United States has ever been involved in. And what happened after that? You would think, you know, in light of this treasonous nation forming and literally spilling blood and rebelling against the Union, there would be some harsh penalties and consequences. When in reality, what happened was the full pardon of Confederate soldiers, amnesty for many Confederate leaders and generals, wealthy people continued to own land. And one of the things I say in my first book, The Color of Compromise, is that racism never goes away. It adapts. And so they adapted after that to sharecropping and convict leasing and continued the economic exploitation of Black people and basically got a slap on the wrist, if that, for rebelling against the nation. And the way that connects to what happened January 6th is that relative leniency led and emboldened more than a century of white supremacist extremism. Because it was clear that the nation, or at least the authorities, weren't going to take strong action. And I think we are seeing the very bitter fruit of those rotten roots, even in
we actually saw a Confederate flag waving in the Statuary Hall.
Goodness. Yeah. So, and we can go on and on and on. We can talk about the KKK as a white nationalist organization. We can talk about what happened during the civil rights movement and the ways they protest and push back against Black civil rights. And we can talk about the marriage of, Christianity and the religious right, which is the third aspect, the spiritual level. So what I'm seeing there is Christian nationalism on full display. When you have people carrying literal crosses, like 4x4 wooden beamed 10, 12 foot crosses up there, you know, it's one step away from just lighting that thing on fire. You have, signs and banners that say Jesus saves right alongside signs and banners that says Trump saves or Jesus 2020 and Trump 2020. Right. So you have all of these religious symbols where they are using the sort of vocabulary and symbolism of Christianity, but importing this nationalist, xenophobic, racist meaning into them. And it is so frustrating because for the past several years, we saw this in the church first, but it also hit the White House when they started issuing executive orders on this stuff about critical race theory. And critical race theory as the biggest threat to Christianity in the U.S., the biggest threat to orthodoxy, et cetera, et cetera. They use this label as a pejorative for basically anyone who was doing any type of racial justice work they didn't like. The they in here is far right fundamentalist Christians who are pushing back against racial justice in the 21st century. And it was a red herring. It distracted us from what has already infiltrated many sectors of the church in the United States, and that's Christian nationalism. So I'm processing it on all those levels.
I know the assembled, I guess, seminary presidents of the denomination that I grew up in all basically kind of got together and banned even, I guess, the use of the term in their seminaries. And that's discouraging. And
listen, I think this is a time to name names. I think this is a time to name names. The Southern Baptist Convention has done egregious things. Yes, they issued the presidents of the SBC seminaries issued an egregious statement condemning critical race theory, saying it is wholly incompatible with Christianity, which actually went against a resolution they passed in 2020, I believe, about it and saying, there are some parts we can learn from and other parts are incompatible. They just did a wholesale thing. And then to go further from an article by Charlie Dates, whose church left the SBC in the wake of this statement, he's privy to all of the conversations and whatnot. And he said it was at the urging of Al Mohler, the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, that they went further and made that statement, because it could have just been a statement in affirmation of the Baptist faith and message on its 20th anniversary. But they had to add that little jab about critical race theory in there. And then Mohler, several months prior to that, came out and said, as a Christian, he couldn't see voting for anyone other than a Republican candidate for president for the foreseeable future, and directly attached that to his Christian faith and theological leanings. And to this day, as far as, you know, as we record on January 7th, has not reputed his support for this president who overtly and explicitly inflamed and encouraged this insurrection.
Yeah, and I agree that it is a time that we name names and we put that on record. I mean, I think this is, as we look back on this time, we're going to be looking back on the record of who voiced and who stayed silent. And I think it's so important. And that's, I think, so interesting that your book is released, I think, at an amazing time in history, because I think people are looking for, those who have their eyes open and ears open are looking for ways, how do we enter this conversation? Like, how do we fight racism? And you start your book with the line, something is different this time. And even though the events of January 6th, you know, bring us back, I think, steps, it does feel like, what do you think is different this time, you know, from spring 2020 moving forward?
Right. So I opened the book with a sort of recounting of the sustained uprisings that we saw from the spring of 2020 through the summer of 2020. About racial justice. And it was spurred most proximately by the murder of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery. But of course, there's a much longer history. And, you know, in the midst of that, it felt different this time. It felt weightier. It felt like there was more momentum. It felt like there was a greater potential for change. And I stand by that. I absolutely stand by that. We saw, so this, the prime example I give is going to seem relatively minor, idiosyncratic to people outside of this area, but it's a major deal. The state of Mississippi finally changed its state flag, which of course was the last one in the Union to have the Confederate battle emblem on it. And mind you, that flag has flown uninterrupted since 1894. Wow. It took 126 years for that flag to come down. And there's a reason it came down in 2020. And so that's just one sign. We can point to lots of different other ones. The other reason I think this time feels different is not simply because of the protests or the progress, but because of the opposition. And so what happened on January 6th is actually part and parcel of the protests and uprisings we saw in 2020, partially as a reaction to that. And so you know the strength of your movement by the strength of the opposition you face. And so we've seen this resurgence in white supremacist extremism and terrorism and violence. And that is in direct proportion to the strength of the movement that's pushing for racial justice.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And being, you know, witness to that over these last couple of days, and seeing that, and seeing how we can continue to move forward on this journey of racial justice. And I like how in the book you call that, you call it a journey of racial justice, and you provide a model that you created called the Arc of Racial Justice. And I think that's a really, you kind of shape the book around that. And I really think that's a powerful way for us to start to answer that question of okay, what can we do, right? How do we make those next steps? So if you could walk us through that arc of racial justice, I'd love that.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. It's designed that way, A, because my brain is simple, and B, I want it to be memorable for other people. So the Arc of Racial Justice is an acronym that stands for Awareness, Relationships, Commitment. And I think you need all three to have a robust, holistic approach to racial justice. Awareness, the knowledge, the data, the facts, the information we need about race, racism, white supremacy, in order to understand what we're dealing with, and to better address it. And so what is awareness building looks like? A lot of different things. It's reading the books, watching the documentaries, listening to the panel discussions, all of those things we do to add information. But we can't just have big heads. We got to have big hearts around this thing, too. Yeah. This is the one I find toughest to explain, because the immediate pushback, which I have, too, is that fighting racism is about much more than individual relationships. The pothole that especially white evangelicals fell into around racial reconciliation was to think that racism is primarily a problem of interpersonal attitudes, one person not liking another. And so the solution then is, well, some of my best friends are Black, or I'm nice to people, you know, I have Black friends or Asian friends or whatever it might be. They stopped there, which is a problem. And I'll get to that in the last portion of the model. But I still think there's a place for relationships. As a matter of fact, I know there is. As a Black person or a person of color, it can be really easy to paint in broad strokes and make white people all the absolute same. Now, I nuance that and say, listen, if you're white, you benefit from whiteness, no matter how woke you are, no matter how sensitive you are to these issues. I understand that. But it's a check on my heart to make sure that I'm not saying all of this stuff divorced from actual relationships with people. But it's even more incumbent, I think, on white people, because even simply being in the numerical majority, it's going to be harder for you to make real good, authentic relationships across racial and ethnic lines. There are simply more of you than there are of us. But beyond that, this nation has been extremely adept at, on purpose, separating white people from other folks. And so there are all of these structures, residentially, educationally, even ecclesiastically, that keep you separated. And so you're going to have to cross all those boundaries and scale all those walls to build relationships. Lastly, we can't just have good relationships because, hey, we can have a great heart to heart on this podcast. We can, you know, when the vaccine has been distributed and we can meet
we can hug each other,
high five, all that stuff. Right. None of that's going to do a thing about mass incarceration, about voter suppression, about Black women dying in maternity-related deaths at 3 times the rate of white women. So what do you do about that stuff? That's where the commitment aspect comes in, that says prejudice works itself out, not just through people, but through policies as well. And so we got to work at the legal level. We got to work the policy level, the practice level, the ways our systems and institutions are structured that create and perpetuate racial inequality. We got to attack that too.
And be willing to, I guess, accept whatever you think is a sacrifice to do it. It may not actually be one, but you might think it is. I've been reminded of that with just the vaccination thing. You know, it's like, I'm probably on level 130Z or something, but, you know, I want to sort of jump the line, but I also have to understand that people of color are being affected by the whole COVID crisis in numbers that people like me aren't. I have a place to go. I have a job that I'm at home right now on this podcast, actually, and other people don't. And honestly, you know, they should be vaccinated first. I mean, they just should be. And I need to understand that and accept that.
And I think you're hitting on something that is critical. So in the book, the chapters are all sort of uniformly structured. There's usually some sort of introductory story that illustrates the broad concept. And then there are two sections, essential understandings and racial justice practices. So the racial justice practices obviously are the practical, hands-on, here's what to do stuff. But I really think part of the treasure of the book, if there is a value to it, is the essential understandings, because that articulates kind of my broader approach to race and how to think about it. And so what you touched on just a moment ago is the idea of sort of communal thinking, in the sense of not groupthink, but in the sense of I'm part of a broader community. Yeah. And I am going to do something that is good for the entire community and not just myself. That's a fundamental shift in thinking. Racial and ethnic minorities have that because we tend to be viewed by society as a group. So the analogy I always use is when I was in seminary, which was overwhelmingly white, over 90% white. If I did badly on a class assignment or something, that would have not just been Jamar did badly. It's see those black people. You know, they can't handle it, or they can't hack it, or whatever it might be. Whereas if one of my white classmates did poorly, that's just John. That's just Mark. He didn't study that night. You know, they're seen as an individual kind of a thing. So that shift of thinking about the good of the group and how this affects us all. COVID is a perfect example, right? Where because, you know, you may be able to work from home or be more affluent and can afford better healthcare, it doesn't affect you the same way, but that's not all that matters. It's about the good of the group. And so I just wanted to highlight, you know, that really important concept that you just mentioned.
Yeah. And in your book, I appreciate how you bring in Christianity explicitly in this conversation, right? That you tie it directly, and you label it as courageous Christianity. So could you highlight what is courageous Christianity? And you also highlight, like, why did you need to tie conversations of race and racism directly to Christianity?
Thank you. Yeah, that subtitle is doing a lot of work there. Courageous Christianity and the Journey Toward Racial Justice. Courageous Christianity in contrast to complicit Christianity, which I talk about in the first book. And so the sordid history of white Christianity in the United States is one pretty much characterized in most cases by compromise and complicity in the face of racism. You can go even further than that, you know, active cooperation and construction of a racist society. But in contrast to that compromising complicity would be courageous Christianity that instead of compromising actually confronts injustice. And so I say in the introduction, you know, I really want this book to be broadly read, and it absolutely can be. You don't have to be Christian. You don't have to claim any faith tradition at all, I think, to glean from this book. But I felt I had to also address Christians because of a couple of things. First and foremost, when it comes to white Christians in this country, they've so often been part of the problem. This is your opportunity to be part of the solution.
Right.
I really think, you know, white Christians need to be at the forefront of this thing, examining their own institutions, their own churches, their own denominations. Yeah.
Perhaps waving a Jesus flag as I climb the Capitol steps before I smash the door.
Well, you know, some the best way to do that. and by saying at the forefront, I mean need to be foot soldiers in this thing, but that doesn't mean taking the lead over and above people of color and black people who've been living this and, you know, have the insights and experience. So I thought we got to bring Christianity in for that. The other thing is on the more positive side, we have so many resources within the Christian tradition for fighting racism and promoting justice. And so in the book, I talk about sort of broad themes, the image of God. I spent a lot of time in the first section of the book talking about this idea that we're all made in God's image, and that gives us inherent dignity and worth. And that tells us so much of what we need to know about how to interact across racial and ethnic lines. But I also talk about love and justice, and justice being love in public, that kind of idea to get at the fact that we can't just approach this on an interpersonal level, but also a systemic and institutional level as well. So again, I think it's accessible to anyone of any faith tradition or no tradition at all. But I do think Christians in this nation absolutely have to be part of the solution. And so it's addressed partially to them.
Yeah,
well,
I think
if any you know, encouragement, actually, and I'm trying actually not to mention the institution right now, but there's a Christian college in California, very, very conservative, that am sort of related to through my son and his in-laws, and his father-in-law is actually on the administration there, and they have decided to have the administrators actually have sort of a book club on The Color of Compromise. And I just felt really, really, you know, that's a good thing. I don't know what's going to come of it or whatever, but those are the people that need to be reading it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they are. I'm glad they are.
Well, it's going to be interesting in groups like that. You mentioned, you know, they might be more on the conservative side. With the first book, The Color of Compromise, I was actually surprised there wasn't more pushback. And I think that's because of two reasons. Number one, you're dealing with history, which is as much as there is a war on facts and information right now, it's a little bit harder to critique. I mean, when you've got the literal primary documents and whatnot, like the words are there, the evidence is there. So it's, you know, you got to get much more creative if you want to just attack the knowledge there. But I think secondly, there was less criticism than I expected because the further back in history you go, the more people think it's distant and doesn't apply to them.
Yeah.
So they didn't feel threatened. But to the extent that there was criticism and pushback, it was on two counts. One, the more recent history, say from the 1960s on. So they really didn't like, you know, when I talked about Billy Graham and his record on race.
And then
they really, really didn't like when I started talking about the moral majority and this connection between Christianity and the GOP. And then on the second, so the more recent history they criticized. And then the second part they criticized was the last chapter, which was dedicated to practical steps we could take. In many ways, you know, The Color of Compromise and How to Fight Racism pair together well, because that last chapter I've essentially expanded into an entire book in How to Fight Racism. But that part where you start talking about, you know, celebrating Juneteenth and taking down Confederate monuments and doing reparations, they love that one. That's the part where they start to push back. So in these groups that study The Color of Compromise, and perhaps even more so How to Fight Racism, I do anticipate most of the pushback and criticism comes when you actually start talking, not in just vague generalities, racism is wrong, but here's what we do about it.
Right. Specific things we do. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's what's interesting there. It's the specific things and actions is what we need to focus on right now. And what, I mean, we need that awareness, definitely, and the historical awareness. And I think for me personally, that's part of what I think this year has been, that something's different this time. At least for me personally, like the more I've dove into the historical record and even this summer thinking, how did the church treat Martin Luther King Jr.? You know, I just asked that question. I never heard that growing up. And then as I look into it, I'm like, oh, not very well.
That's right.
It's like, wow, how can we learn from that? So you need that. And that's been good for me. But we also then we need to look at, okay, what do we do next? Like, how do we step in more? And we have to be able to talk about that. One question that I wanted to ask you is, and part of it is with this, like with maybe more current conversations, is within the church, how would you help us have conversations about slogans and movements like Black Lives Matter, right? Mm-hmm. Because especially, and I'm a pastor in a predominantly white church, and that's where people always push back, you know, and I think like this is a clear and obvious statement that is true and we should easily support, but people always push back with, it hits too close to home. There's this separation of movement versus organization. Mm-hmm. How would you kind of guide us on that?
A couple of things, and they're pretty broad, but I hope helpful. One, at the beginning of 2021, if people are still rigorously pushing back against Black Lives Matter, I don't think they're going to change their minds very soon.
Yeah, that's true.
We have seen so much in 2020 alone, and we're continuing to see it, such that if people want to cling to this idea that in no way, shape, or form should a Christian be involved with, affirm, or even say the words Black Lives Matter, I just don't think you're going to get very far very quickly with them. And to me, that is a signal to say, I love you, but I got to keep moving. Yeah. I don't know if that means disfellowshipping and going to another church. I don't know if that simply means I'm going to unfriend you on Facebook, that kind of a thing. But I would be very cautious about expending so much energy at this point on people mm-hmm. who are still pushing back so hard against the phrase and the movement. The second thing is, in general, the people I find protesting most loudly against Black Lives Matter aren't doing anything besides that, aren't doing anything right. to advance right. racial justice in a substantive way. And so they're spending all this time and energy critiquing the movement that is happening while using it as an excuse not to get involved in the movement at all. And so the immediate question one can ask is, okay, you don't like BLM, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And it'll probably be right. along the lines of, I'm preaching the gospel, I'm nice to people, you know,
yeah.
But when it comes to, you know, actually changing laws about, I don't ever want us to forget that the 2020 uprisings were about anti-Black police brutality. Mm-hmm. And so you could yeah. ask an even more pointed question for the people who are objecting to the use of the term or the movement. What are you doing about anti-Black police brutality?
Yeah.
It will be crickets 95% of the time.
Right.
So all of that in mind, and if you're a leader at the church, speak the truth in love. Mm-hmm. Like, look, I've been doing this long enough. There is no way to contextualize, soften, tiptoe around these issues enough that someone is not going to push back. Doesn't matter how right. careful or circumspect right. you are. So why not take that burden off yourself? Just yeah. speak the truth and allow people the dignity of deciding for themselves whether they want to believe it or not and what they want to do with it. And so I would just encourage people who have a voice in leadership at their churches, now is the time for bold truth in love, but understanding that the truth divides and that may be a necessary division. Yeah,
that's so helpful. Thank you so much for that. And thank you again for coming back on the show. I wish we had more time. Maybe we'll have to get you back.
Exactly.
Back
on the part two. I'm sure there'll be more we can tackle.
Yeah, exactly. And with this being your second time on the show, you officially become a friend of the show.
Oh, very good. So, a button or a sticker?
I was supposed to get a t-shirt, but I'm still waiting on mine.
We're working on t-shirts. We're working. Go. Maybe 2021, we can finally get those t-shirts.
Put me in the line. Yes.
There we go. We will. But thanks again. And we're so excited about your book, which was released on January 5th. You can get it anywhere. Books are available.
Visit howtofightracism.com. Howtofightracism.com will get you fixed up.
Awesome. That is perfect. Thanks again, Jamar.
Fun talking to you guys. Thanks for the invite.
Thank you for listening to Jessup Think. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Jessup Think. We would love to hear your thoughts on the episode and engage with any questions you have. Our aim is to provide a framework for further reflection and deeper exploration of these important topics. You can also help the show by leaving a review on iTunes. These reviews help the podcast reach new listeners. Until next time, I'm Mark Moore, and this is Jessup Think.
If you're interested in learning more about Jessup, please visit us at jessup.edu. William Jessup is the premier, fully accredited, four-year Christian university in the Sacramento area, offering over 60 academic programs in undergraduate and graduate studies, designed to see every student equipped and transformed into the leader they are called to be. As you go, don't forget to hit subscribe and share so you never miss an episode. Thanks for joining us for Jessup Think.